became incapable of letting him alone, talking at him, commenting on his stupidity and idleness, expressing her wonder how he could endure the life he lived, how he could sit a whole evening staring into the fire and dozing. "He's just like a dog, is he not, Ellen?" she once observed. "Or a cart horse. He does his work, eats his food, and sleeps eternally. What a blank, dreary mind he must have. Do you ever dream, Hareton? And if you do, what is it about?" "Ah, but you can't speak to me." Then she looked at him, but he would neither open his mouth nor look again. "He's perhaps dreaming now," she continued. He twitched his shoulder as Juno twitches hers. "Ask him, Ellen."
"Mr. Hareton will ask the master to send you upstairs if you don't behave," I said.
He had not only twitched his shoulder, but clenched his fist, as if tempted to use it. "I know why Hareton never speaks when I am in the kitchen," she exclaimed on another occasion. "He is afraid I shall laugh at him. Ellen, what do you think? He began to teach himself to read once, and because I laughed, he burned his books and dropped it. Was he not a fool?"
"Were not you naughty?" I said. "Answer me that."
"Perhaps I was," she went on. "But I did not expect him to be so silly. Hareton, if I gave you a book, would you take it now?"
"I'll try."
She placed one she had been perusing on his hand. He flung it off and muttered if she did not give over, he would break her neck. "Well, I shall put it here," she said. "In the table drawer, and I'm going to bed." Then she whispered to me to watch whether he touched it, and departed. But he would not come near it, and so I informed her in the morning, to her great disappointment. I saw she was sorry for his persevering sulkiness and indolence. Her conscience reproved her for fighting him off improving himself. She had done it effectually. But her ingenuity was at work to remedy the injury. While I ironed or pursued other such stationary employments as I could not well do in the parlour, she would bring some pleasant volume and read it aloud to me. When Hareton was there, she generally paused in an interesting part and left the book lying about. That she did repeatedly, but he was as obstinate as a mule, and instead of snatching at her bait, in wet weather he took to smoking with Joseph, and they sat like automatons, one on each side of the fire, the elder happily too deaf to understand her wicked nonsense, as he would have called it, the younger doing his best to seem to disregard it. On fine evenings, the latter followed his shooting expeditions, and Catherine yawned and sighed, and teased me to talk to her, and ran off into the court or garden the moment I began, and, as a last resource, cried, and said she was tired of living, her life was useless. Mr. Heathcliff, who grew more and more disinclined to society, had almost banished Earnshaw from his apartment. Owing to an accident at the commencement of March, he became for some days a fixture in the kitchen. His gun burst while out in the hills by himself. A splinter cut his arm, and he lost a good deal of blood before he could reach home. The consequence was that perforce he was condemned to the fireside and tranquillity till he made it up again. It suited Catherine to have him there. At any rate, it made her hate her room upstairs more than ever. And she would compel me to find out business below that she might accompany me. On Easter Monday, Joseph went to Gimmerton Fair with some cattle, and in the afternoon I was busy getting up linen in the kitchen. Earnshaw sat morose as usual, at the chimney corner, and my little mistress was beguiling an idle hour with drawing pictures on the window panes, varying her amusement by smothered bursts of song and whispered ejaculations and quick glances of annoyance and impatience in the direction of her cousin, who steadfastly smoked and looked into the grate. At a notice that I could do with her no longer intercepting my light, she removed to the hearthstone. I bestowed little attention on her proceedings, but presently I heard her begin. "I've found out, Hareton, that I want... that I'm glad, that I should like you to be my cousin now.
if you had not grown so cross to me and so rough." Hareton returned no answer.
"Hareton! Hareton! Hareton! Do you hear?"
she continued.
"Get off wi' you,"
he growled with uncompromising gruffness. "Let me take that pipe," she said, cautiously advancing her hand and abstracting it from his mouth. Before he could attempt to recover it, it was broken and behind the fire. He swore at her and seized another.
"Stop!"
she cried.
"You must listen to me first, and I can't speak while those clouds are floating in my face." "Will you go to the devil?"
he exclaimed ferociously.
"And let me be!"
"No," she persisted. "I won't. I can't tell what to do to make you talk to me, and you are determined not to understand. When I call you stupid, I don't mean anything. I don't mean that I despise you. Come, you shall take notice of me. Hareton, you are my cousin, and you shall own me."
"I shall have nought to do with you, and your mucky pride, and your damned mocking tricks,"
he answered.
"I'll go to hell, body and soul, before I look sideways after you again. Side out at gate now, this minute."
Catherine frowned and retreated to the window seat, chewing her lip, and endeavouring by humming an eccentric tune to conceal a growing tendency to sob.
"You should be friends with your cousin, Mr. Hareton," I interrupted. "Since she repents of her sauciness, it would do you a great deal of good. It would make you another man to have her for a companion."
"A companion?" he cried.
"When she hates me and does not think me fit to wipe her shoon? Nay, if it made me king, I'd not be scorned for seeking her goodwill any more." "It is not I who hate you, it is you who hate me,"
wept Cathy, no longer disguising her trouble.
"You hate me as much as Mr. Heathcliff does, and more."
"You're a damned liar," began Earnshaw.
"Why have I made him angry by taking your part then 100 times? And that, when you sneered at and despised me and go on plaguing me and I'll step in yonder and say you worried me out of the kitchen."
"I didn't know you took my part," she answered, drying her eyes. "And I was miserable and bitter at everybody. But now I thank you and beg you to forgive me. What can I do besides?"
She returned to the hearth and frankly extended her hand.
He blackened and scowled like a thundercloud and kept his fists resolutely clenched and his gaze fixed on the ground. Catherine, by instinct, must have divined it was obdurate perversity and not dislike. That prompted this dogged conduct, for after remaining an instant undecided, she stooped and impressed on his cheek a gentle kiss. The little rogue thought I had not seen her, and drawing back, she took her former station by the window, quite demurely. I shook my head reprovingly, and then she blushed and whispered,
"Well, what should I have done, Ellen? He wouldn't shake hands, and he wouldn't look. I must show him some way that I like him, that I want to be friends."
Whether the kiss convinced Hareton, I cannot tell. He was very careful for some minutes that his face should not be seen, and when he did raise it, he was sadly puzzled where to turn his eyes. Catherine employed herself in wrapping a handsome book neatly in white paper, and having tied it with a bit of ribbon and addressed it to Mr. Hareton Earnshaw, she desired me to be her ambassadress and convey the present to its destined recipient. "And tell him, if he'll take it, I'll come and teach him to read it right," she said. "And if he refuses it, I'll go upstairs and never tease him again." I carried it and repeated the message, anxiously watched by my employer. Hareton would not open his fingers, so I laid it on his knee. He did not strike it off either. I returned to my work. Catherine leaned her head and arms on the table till she heard the slight rustle of the covering being removed. Then she stole away and quietly seated herself beside her cousin. He trembled and his face glowed. All his rudeness and all his surly harshness had deserted him. He could not summon courage at first to utter a syllable in reply to her questioning look and her murmured petition.
Say you forgive me, Hareton. Do. You can make me so happy by speaking that little word.
He muttered something inaudible.
And you'll be my friend?
Added Catherine, interrogatively. Nay, you'll be ashamed of me every day of your life, he answered.
And the more ashamed, the more you know me, and I cannot bide it. So you won't be my friend?
She said, smiling as sweet as honey and creeping close up. I overheard no further distinguishable talk, but, on looking round again, I perceived two such radiant countenances bent over the page of the accepted book that I did not doubt the treaty had been ratified on both sides, and the enemies were thenceforth sworn allies. The work they studied was full of costly pictures, and those in their position had charm enough to keep them unmoved till Joseph came home. He, poor man, was perfectly aghast at the spectacle of Catherine seated on the same bench with Hareton Earnshaw, leaning her hand on his shoulder, and confounded at his favourite's endurance of her proximity. It affected him too deeply to allow an observation on the subject that night. His emotion was only revealed by the immense sighs he drew as he solemnly spread his large Bible on the table and overlaid it with dirty banknotes from his pocketbook, the produce of the day's transactions. At length, he summoned Hareton from his seat.
"Take these into Maester, lad," he said, "and bide there. I's gone up to my own ram. This oil's neither menseful nor seemly for us. We mun side out and search another."
"Come, Catherine," I said. "We must side out too. I've done my ironing. Are you ready to go?" "It is not 8 o'clock," she answered, rising unwillingly. "Hareton, I'll leave this book up on the chimney-piece, and I'll bring some more tomorrow."
"Any books that you leave, I shall take into arse," said Joseph. "And it'll be mitch if you find him again, so you may please yoursen."
Cathy threatened that his library should pay for hers, and smiling as she passed Hareton, went singing upstairs, lighter of heart, I venture to say, than ever she had been under that roof before, except perhaps during her earliest visits to Linton. The intimacy thus commenced grew rapidly, though it encountered temporary interruptions. Earnshaw was not to be civilized with a wish, and my young lady was no philosopher, and no paragon of patience. But both their minds tending to the same point, one loving and desiring to esteem, and the other loving and desiring to be esteemed, they contrived in the end to reach it. "You see, Mr. Lockwood, it was easy enough to win Mrs. Heathcliff's heart, but now I'm glad you did not try. The crown of all my wishes will be the union of those two. I shall envy no one on their wedding day. There won't be a happier woman than myself in England."
Chapter 33. On the morrow of that Monday, Earnshaw being still unable to follow his ordinary employments, and therefore remaining about the house, I speedily found it would be impractical to retain my charge beside me as heretofore. She got downstairs before me, and out into the garden, where she had seen her cousin performing some easy work, and when I went to bid them come to breakfast, I saw she had persuaded him to clear a large space of ground from currant and gooseberry bushes, and they were busy planning together an importation of plants from the Grange. I was terrified at the devastation which had been accomplished in a brief half-hour. The blackcurrant trees were the apple of Joseph's eye, and she had just fixed her choice of a flower-bed in the midst of them.
"There! That will be all shown to the master!"
I exclaimed. "The minute it is discovered! And what excuse have you to offer for taking such liberties with the garden? We shall have a fine explosion on the head of it, see if we don't. Mr. Hareton, I wonder you should have no more wit than to go and make that mess at her bidding."
"I'd forgotten they were Joseph's," answered Earnshaw, rather puzzled. "But I'll tell him I did it." We always ate our meals with Mr. Heathcliff. I held the mistress's post in making tea and carving, so I was indispensable at table. Catherine usually sat by me, but today she stole nearer to Hareton, and I presently saw,
she would have no more discretion in her friendship than she had in her hostility.
"Now, mind you don't talk with and notice your cousin too much," were my whispered instructions as we entered the room. "It will certainly annoy Mr. Heathcliff, and he'll be mad at you both."
"I'm not going to," she answered. The minute after, she had sidled to him and was sticking primroses in his plate of porridge. He dared not speak to her there. He dared hardly look. And yet she went on teasing, till he was twice on the point of being provoked to laugh. I frowned, and then she glanced towards the master, whose mind was occupied on other subjects than his company, as his countenance evinced. And she grew serious for an instant, scrutinizing him with deep gravity. Afterwards she turned and recommenced her nonsense. At last Hareton uttered a smothered laugh. Mr. Heathcliff started, his eye rapidly surveyed our faces. Catherine met it with her accustomed look of nervousness and yet defiance, which he abhorred.
"It is well you are out of my reach," he exclaimed. "What fiend possesses you to stare back at me, continually with those infernal eyes? Down with them, and don't remind me of your existence again. I thought I had cured you of laughing."
"It was me," muttered Hareton.
"What do you say?"
demanded the master. Hareton looked at his plate and did not repeat the confession. Mr. Heathcliff looked at him a bit, and then silently resumed his breakfast and his interrupted musing. We had nearly finished, and the two young people prudently shifted wider asunder, so I anticipated no further disturbance during that sitting. When Joseph appeared at the door, revealing by his quivering lip and furious eye that the outrage committed on his precious shrubs was detected. He must have seen Cathy and her cousin about the spot before he examined it. For while his jaws worked like those of a cow chewing its cud, and rendered his speech difficult to understand, he began.
"I mun have my word and I mun go. I had aimed to dee where I'd served for 60 years, and I'd thought I'd lug my books up into garret and all my bits of stuff, and they should have kitchen to their cells for the sake of quietness. It were hard to give up my own hearthstone, but I thought I could do that. But nah, shoes tan my garden from me, and by thy heart, master, I cannot stand it. You may bend to yoke and you will. I none used to, an old man doesn't soon get used to new barthens. I'd rather earn me bite and me sup wi' a amarant road."
Now, idiot," interrupted Heathcliff. "Cut it short. What's your grievance? I'll interfere in no quarrels between you and Nelly. She may thrust you into the coal hole for anything I care."
"It's no Nelly," answered Joseph. "I shouldn't shift for Nelly, nasty old nowt to shoe is. Thank God shoe cannot steal a soul of nobody. Shoe were never so handsome, but what a body would look at her with... about winking. It's yon flaresome graceless queen that's witched our lad, wi' her balding and her forrard ways, till, nay, it's fair burst my heart. He's forgotten all I've done for him and made on him, and gone and riven up all row at grandest currant trees in garden."
And here he lamented outright, unmanned by a sense of his bitter injuries and Earnshaw's ingratitude and dangerous condition.
"Is the fool drunk?"
asked Mr. Heathcliff.
"Hareton, is it you he's finding fault with?"
"I've pulled up 2 or 3 bushes," replied the young man. "But I'm going to set him again."
"And why have you pulled them up?"
said the master. Catherine wisely put in her tongue.
"We wanted to plant some flowers there,"
she cried.
"I'm the only person to blame, for I wished him to do it."
"And who the devil gave you leave to touch a stick about the place?"
demanded her father-in-law, much surprised.
"And who ordered you to obey her?"
he added, turning to Hareton. The latter was speechless. His cousin replied,
"You shouldn't grudge a few yards of earth for me to ornament, when you have taken all my land."
"Your land, insolent slut, you never had any,"
said Heathcliff.
"And my money,"
she continued, returning his angry glare, and meantime biting a piece of crust, the remnant of her breakfast.
"Silence!"
he exclaimed.
Get done and be gone.
And Hareton's land and his money, pursued the reckless thing. Hareton and I are friends now, and I shall tell him all about you. The master seemed confounded a moment. He grew pale and rose up, eyeing her all the while with an expression of mortal hate.
If you strike me, Hareton will strike you, she said. So you may as well sit down.
If Hareton does not turn you out of the room, I'll strike him to hell,
thundered Heathcliff.
Damnable witch, dare you pretend to rouse him against me? Off with her, do you hear? Fling her into the kitchen. I'll kill her, Ellen Dean, if you let her come into my sight again.
Hareton tried under his breath to persuade her to go.
Drag her away,
he cried savagely.
Are you staying to talk?
And he approached to execute his own command.
He'll not obey you, wicked man, any more, said Catherine. And he'll soon detest you as much as I do.
Whist, whist,
muttered the young man reproachfully. I will not hear you speak so to him. Have done.
But you won't let him strike me,
she cried.
Come then,
he whispered earnestly. It was too late. Heathcliff had caught hold of her.
Now you go, he said to Earnshaw. Accursed witch, this time she has provoked me when I could not bear it, and I'll make her repent it forever.
He had his hand in her hair. Hareton attempted to release her locks, entreating him not to hurt her that once. Heathcliff's black eyes flashed. He seemed ready to tear Catherine in pieces, and I was just worked up to risk coming to the rescue, when of a sudden his fingers relaxed. He shifted his grasp from her head to her arm and gazed intently in her face. Then he drew his hand over his eyes, stood a moment to collect himself apparently, and turning anew to Catherine said, with assumed calmness,
"You must learn to avoid putting me in a passion, or I shall really murder you sometime. Go with Mrs. Dean and keep with her, and confine your insolence to her ears. As to Hareton Earnshaw, if I see him listen to you, I'll send him seeking his bread where he can get it. Your love will make him an outcast and a beggar. Nelly, take her, and leave me, all of you, leave me."
I led my young lady out. She was too glad of her escape to resist. The other followed, and Mr. Heathcliff had the room to himself till dinner. I had counselled Catherine to dine upstairs, but as soon as he perceived her vacant seat, he sent me to call her. He spoke to none of us, ate very little, and went out directly afterwards, intimating that he should not return before evening. The two new friends established themselves in the house during his absence, where I heard Hareton sternly check his cousin on her offering a revelation of her father-in-law's conduct to his father. He said he wouldn't suffer a word to be uttered in his disparagement. If he were the devil, it didn't signify. He would stand by him, and he'd rather she would abuse himself, as she used to, than begin on Mr. Heathcliff. Catherine was waxing cross at this, but he found means to make her hold her tongue by asking how she would like him to speak ill of her father. Then she comprehended that Earnshaw took the master's reputation home to himself and was attached by ties stronger than reason could break. Chains forged by habit, which it would be cruel to attempt to loosen. She showed a good heart thenceforth in avoiding both complaints and expressions of antipathy concerning Heathcliff, and confessed to me her sorrow that she had endeavoured to raise a bad spirit between him and Hareton. Indeed, I don't believe she has ever breathed a syllable in the latter's hearing against her oppressor since. When this slight disagreement was over, they were friends again, and as busy as possible in their several occupations of pupil and teacher. I came in to sit with them after I had done my work, and I felt so soothed and comforted to watch them that I did not notice how time got on. You know, they both appeared in a measure my children. I had long been proud of one, and now I was sure the other would be a source of equal satisfaction. His honest, warm, and intelligent nature shook off rapidly the clouds of ignorance and degradation in which it had been bred, and Catherine's sincere commendations acted as a spur to his industry. His brightening mind brightened his features, and added spirit and nobility to their aspect. I could hardly fancy it the same individual I had beheld on the day I discovered my little lady at Wuthering Heights, after her expedition to the crags. While I admired and they laboured, dusk drew on, and with it returned the master. He came upon us quite unexpectedly, entering by the front way, and had a full view of the whole three ere we could raise our heads to glance at him. Well, I reflected, there was never a pleasanter or more harmless sight, and it will be a burning shame to scold them. The red firelight glowed on their two bonny heads, and revealed their faces animated with the eager interest of children. For though he was 23 and she 18, each had so much of novelty to feel and learn, that neither experienced nor evinced the sentiments of sober disenchanted maturity. They lifted their eyes together to encounter Mr. Heathcliff. Perhaps you have never remarked that their eyes are precisely similar, and they are those of Catherine Earnshaw. The present Catherine has no other likeness to her, except a breadth of forehead and a certain arch of the nostril that makes her appear rather haughty, whether she will or not. With Hareton, the resemblance is carried farther. It is singular at all times. Then, it was particularly striking, because his senses were alert and his mental faculties wakened to unwonted activity. I suppose this resemblance disarmed Mr. Heathcliff. He walked to the hearth in evident agitation, but it quickly subsided as he looked at the young man, or I should say, altered its character, for it were there yet. He took the book from his hand and glanced at the open page, then returned it without any observation, merely signing Catherine away. Her companion lingered very little behind her, and I was about to depart also, but he bid me sit still.
"It is a poor conclusion, is it not?" he observed, having brooded a while on the scene he had just witnessed. "An absurd termination to my violent exertions. I get levers and matlocks to demolish the two houses, and train myself to be capable of working like Hercules, and when everything is ready and in my power, I find the will to lift a slate off either roof has vanished. My old enemies have not beaten me. Now would be the precise time to revenge myself on their representatives. I could do it, and none could hinder me. But where is the use? I don't care for striking. I can't take the trouble to raise my hand. That sounds as if I had been labouring the whole time only to exhibit a fine trait of magnanimity. It is far from being the case. I have lost the faculty of enjoying their destruction, and I am too idle to destroy for nothing. Nelly, there is a strange change approaching. I am in its shadow at present. I take so little interest in my daily life that I hardly remember to eat and drink. Those two who have left the room are the only objects which retain a distinct material appearance to me. And that appearance causes me pain, amounting to agony. About her I won't speak, and I don't desire to think, but I earnestly wish she were invisible. Her presence invokes only maddening sensations. He moves me differently. And yet, if I could do it without seeming insane, I'd never see him again. You'll perhaps think me rather inclined to become so, he added, making an effort to smile. If I try to describe the thousand forms of past associations and ideas he awakens or embodies. But you'll not talk of what I tell you, and my mind is so eternally secluded in itself. It is tempting at last to turn it out to another. 5 minutes ago, Hareton seemed a personification of my youth, not a human being. I felt to him in such a variety of ways that it would have been impossible to have accosted him rationally. In the first place, his startling likeness to Catherine connected him fearfully with her. That, however, which you may suppose the most potent to arrest my imagination is actually the least. For what is not connected with her to me, and what does not recall her? I cannot look down to this floor, but her features are shaped in the flags. In every cloud, in every tree, filling the air at night, and caught by glimpses in every object by day. I am surrounded with her image. The most ordinary faces of men and women, my own features, mock me with a resemblance. The entire world is a dreadful collection of memoranda that she did exist and that I have lost her. Well, Hareton's aspect was the ghost of my immortal love. All my wild endeavours to hold my right. My degradation, my pride, my happiness and my anguish. But it is frenzy to repeat these thoughts to you. Only it will let you know why, with a reluctance to be always alone, his society is no benefit, rather an aggravation of the constant torment I suffer. And it partly contributes to render me regardless how he and his cousin go on together. I can give them no attention any more.
But what do you mean by a change, Mr. Heathcliff? I said, alarmed at his manner, though he was neither in danger of losing his senses nor dying according to my judgment. He was quite strong and healthy, and as to his reason, from childhood he had a delight in dwelling on dark things and entertaining odd fancies. He might have had a monomania on the subject of his departed idol, but on every other point his wits were as sound as mine.
I shall not know that till it comes, he said. I'm only half conscious of it now.
You have no feeling of illness, have you? I asked.
No, Nelly, I have not, he answered.
Then you are not afraid of death? I pursued.
Afraid? No, he replied. I have neither fear nor presentiment, nor a hope of death. Why should I? With my hard constitution and temperate mode of living and unperilous occupations, I ought to and probably shall remain above ground till there is scarcely a black hair on my head. And yet I cannot continue in this condition. I have to remind myself to breathe, almost to remind my heart to beat. And it is like bending back a stiff spring. It is by compulsion that I do the slightest act not prompted by one thought, and by compulsion that I notice anything alive or dead, which is not associated with one universal idea. I have a single wish. My whole being and faculties are yearning to attain it. They have yearned towards it so long, and so unwaveringly that I am convinced it will be reached, and soon, because it has devoured my existence. I am swallowed up in the anticipation of its fulfillment. My confessions have not relieved me, but they may account for some otherwise unaccountable phases of humour which I show. Oh, God, it is a long fight. I wish it were over.
He began to pace the room, muttering terrible things to himself, till I was inclined to believe, as he said Joseph did, that conscience had turned his heart to an earthly hell. I wondered greatly how it would end. Though he seldom before had revealed this state of mind, even by looks, it was his habitual mood, I had no doubt. He asserted it himself, but not a soul, from his general bearing, would have conjectured the fact. You did not when you saw him, Mr. Lockwood. And at the period of which I speak, he was just the same as then, only fonder of continued solitude, and perhaps still more laconic in company. Chapter 34. For some days after that evening, Mr. Heathcliff shunned meeting us at meals, yet he would not consent formally to exclude Hareton and Cathy. He had an aversion to yielding so completely to his feelings, choosing rather to absent himself, and eating once in 24 hours seemed sufficient sustenance for him. One night, after the family were in bed, I heard him go downstairs, and out at the front door. I did not hear him re-enter, and in the morning I found he was still away. We were in April then, the weather was sweet and warm, the grass as green as showers and sun could make it, and the two dwarf apple trees near the southern wall in full bloom. After breakfast, Catherine insisted on my bringing a chair and sitting with my work under the fir trees at the end of the house, and she beguiled Hareton, who had perfectly recovered from his accident, to dig and arrange her little garden. which was shifted to that corner by the influence of Joseph's complaints. I was comfortably reveling in the spring fragrance around and the beautiful soft blue overhead when my young lady, who had run down near the gate to procure some primrose roots for a border, returned only half laden and informed us that Mr. Heathcliff was coming in. "And he spoke to me," she added with a perplexed countenance.
"What did he say?"
asked Hareton.
"He told me to be gone as fast as I could,"
she answered. "But he looked so different from his usual look that I stopped a moment to stare at him."
"How?"
he inquired.
"Why, almost bright and cheerful. No, almost nothing, very much excited and wild and glad,"
she replied. "Night walking amuses him, then," I remarked, affecting a careless manner, in reality as surprised as she was and anxious to ascertain the truth of her statement, for to see the master looking glad would not be an everyday spectacle. I framed an excuse to go in. Heathcliff stood at the open door. He was pale and he trembled, yet certainly he had a strange joyful glitter in his eyes that altered the aspect of his whole face.
"Will you have some breakfast?"
I said. "You must be hungry, rambling about all night." I wanted to discover where he had been, but I did not like to ask directly.
"No, I'm not hungry,"
he answered, averting his head and speaking rather contemptuously, as if he guessed I was trying to divine the occasion of his good humour. I felt perplexed. I didn't know whether it were not a proper opportunity to offer a bit of admonition. "I don't think it right to wander out of doors," I observed, "instead of being in bed. It is not wise, at any rate, this moist season. I dare say you'll catch a bad cold or a fever. You have something the matter with you now."
"Nothing but what I can bear," he replied, "and with the greatest pleasure, provided you'll leave me alone. Get in and don't annoy me."
I obeyed, and in passing, I noticed he breathed as fast as a cat. "Yes," I reflected to myself, "we shall have a fit of illness. I cannot conceive what he has been doing." That noon, he sat down to dinner with us and received a heaped-up plate from my hands, as if he intended to make amends for previous fasting.
"I've neither cold nor fever, Nelly," he remarked, in allusion to my morning speech, "and I'm ready to do justice to the food you give me."
He took his knife and fork and was going to commence eating, when the inclination appeared to become suddenly extinct. He laid them on the table, looked eagerly towards the window, then rose and went out. We saw him walking to and fro in the garden while we concluded our meal, and Earnshaw said he'd go and ask why he would not dine. He thought we had grieved him some way.
"Well, is he coming?"
cried Catherine when her cousin returned.
"Nay," he answered. "But he's not angry. He seemed rarely pleased indeed. Only I made him impatient by speaking to him twice, and then he bid me be off to you. He wondered how I could want the company of anybody else."
I set his plate to keep warm on the fender, and after an hour or two he re-entered, when the room was clear, in no degree calmer. The same unnatural, it was unnatural, appearance of joy under his black brows, the same bloodless hue, and his teeth visible, now and then, in a kind of smile. His frame shivering, not as one shivers with chill or weakness, but as a tight, stretched cord vibrates, a strong thrilling rather than trembling. "I will ask what the matter is," I thought, "or who should?" And I exclaimed,
"Have you heard any good news, Mr. Heathcliff? You look uncommonly animated."
"Where should good news come from to me?" he said. "I'm animated with hunger, and seemingly I must not eat."
"Your dinner is here," I returned. "Why won't you get it?"
"I don't want it now," he muttered hastily. "I'll wait till supper. And Nelly, once for all, let me beg you to warn Hareton and the other away from me. I wish to be troubled by nobody. I wish to have this place to myself."
"Is there some new reason for this banishment?"
I inquired. Tell me why you were so queer, Mr. Heathcliff. Where were you last night? I'm not putting the question through idle curiosity, but...
You were putting the question through very idle curiosity.
He interrupted with a laugh.
Yet I'll answer it. Last night I was on the threshold of hell. Today I am within sight of my heaven. I have my eyes on it. Hardly 3 feet to sever me. And now you'd better go. You'll neither see nor hear anything to frighten you if you refrain from prying.
Having swept the hearth and wiped the table, I departed, more perplexed than ever. He did not quit the house again that afternoon, and no one intruded on his solitude till at 8 o'clock I deemed it proper, though unsummoned, to carry a candle and his supper to him. He was leaning against the ledge of an open lattice, but not looking out. His face was turned to the interior gloom. The fire had smouldered to ashes. The room was filled with the damp, mild air of the cloudy evening, and so still that not only the murmur of the Beckdown Gimmerton was distinguishable, but its ripples and its gurgling over the pebbles, or through the large stones which it could not cover. I uttered an ejaculation of discontent at seeing the dismal grate, and commenced shutting the casements, one after another, till I came to his.
"Must I close this?"
I asked in order to rouse him, for he would not stir. The light flashed on his features as I spoke. "Oh, Mr. Lockwood, I cannot express what a terrible start I got by the momentary view. Those deep black eyes, that smile and ghastly paleness. It appeared to me not Mr. Heathcliff but a goblin, and in my terror I let the candle bend towards the wall and it left me in darkness."
"Yes, close it," he replied in his familiar voice. "There, that is pure awkwardness. Why did you hold the candle horizontally? Be quick and bring another."
I hurried out in a foolish state of dread and said to Joseph, "The master wishes you to take him a light and rekindle the fire," for I dared not go in myself again just then. Joseph rattled some fire into the shovel and went, but he brought it back immediately, with the supper tray in his other hand, explaining that Mr. Heathcliff was going to bed and he wanted nothing to eat till morning. We heard him mount the stairs directly. He did not proceed to his ordinary chamber, but turned into that with the panelled bed. Its window, as I mentioned before, is wide enough for anybody to get through, and it struck me that he plotted another midnight excursion, of which he had rather we had no suspicion. "Is he a ghoul or a vampire?" I mused. I had read of such hideous incarnate demons. And then I sat myself to reflect how I had tended him in infancy, and watched him grow to youth, and followed him almost through his whole course, and what absurd nonsense it was to yield to that sense of horror. But where did he come from, the little dark thing, harboured by a good man to his bane? Muttered superstition as I dozed into unconsciousness. And I began, half dreaming, to weary myself with imagining some fit parentage for him, and repeating my waking meditations, I tracked his existence over again, with grim variations, at last picturing his death and funeral. Of which all I can remember is being exceedingly vexed at having the task of dictating an inscription for his monument, and consulting the sexton about it, and, as he had no surname and we could not tell his age, we were obliged to content ourselves with the single word Heathcliff. That came true. We were. If you enter the kirkyard, you'll read on his headstone only that and the date of his death. Dawn restored me to common sense. I rose and went into the garden as soon as I could see to ascertain if there were any footmarks under his window. There were none. "He has stayed at home," I thought, "and he'll be all right today." I prepared breakfast for the household, as was my usual custom, but told Hareton and Catherine to get theirs ere the master came down, for he lay late. They preferred taking it out of doors under the trees, and I set a little table to accommodate them. On my re-entrance, I found Mr. Heathcliff below. He and Joseph were conversing about some farming business. He gave clear, minute directions concerning the matter discussed, but he spoke rapidly, and turned his head continually aside,
and had the same excited expression, even more exaggerated. When Joseph quitted the room, he took his seat in the place he generally chose, and I put a basin of coffee before him. He drew it nearer, and then rested his arms on the table and looked at the opposite wall, as I supposed, surveying one particular portion up and down, with glittering, restless eyes, and with such eager interest that he stopped breathing during half a minute together.
"Come now," I exclaimed, pushing some bread against his hand. "Eat and drink that while it is hot. It has been waiting near an hour."
He didn't notice me, and yet he smiled. I'd rather have seen him gnash his teeth than smile so.
"Mr. Heathcliff, master,"
I cried.
"Don't for God's sake stare as if you saw an unearthly vision."
"Don't for God's sake shout so loud," he replied. "Turn round and tell me. Are we by ourselves?"
"Of course," was my answer. "Of course we are." Still, I involuntarily obeyed him, as if I was not quite sure. With a sweep of his hand, he cleared a vacant space in front among the breakfast things and leant forward to gaze more at his ease. Now I perceived he was not looking at the wall, but when I regarded him alone, it seemed exactly that he gazed at something within 2 yards distance. And whatever it was, it communicated, apparently, both pleasure and pain in exquisite extremes. At least the anguished yet raptured expression of his countenance suggested that idea. The fancied object was not fixed either. His eyes pursued it with unwearied diligence, and, even in speaking to me, were never weaned away. I vainly reminded him of his protracted abstinence from food. If he stirred to touch anything in compliance with my entreaties, if he stretched his hand out to get a piece of bread, his fingers clenched before they reached it and remained on the table, forgetful of their aim. I sat a model of patience, trying to attract his absorbed attention from its engrossing speculation, till he grew irritable and got up asking why I would not allow him to have his own time in taking his meals, and saying that on the next occasion I needn't wait. I might set the things down and go. Having uttered these words, he left the house, slowly sauntered down the garden path, and disappeared through the gate. The hours crept anxiously by. Another evening came. I did not retire to rest till late, and when I did, I could not sleep. He returned after midnight, and instead of going to bed, shut himself into the room beneath. I listened and tossed about, and finally dressed and descended. It was too irksome to lie there, harassing my brain with 100 idle misgivings. I distinguished Mr. Heathcliff's step, restlessly measuring the floor, and he frequently broke the silence by a deep inspiration, resembling a groan. He muttered detached words also. The only one I could catch was the name of Catherine, coupled with some wild term of endearment or suffering, and spoken as one would speak to a person present, low and earnest and wrung from the depth of his soul. I had not courage to walk straight into the apartment, but I desired to divert him from his reverie, and therefore fell foul of the kitchen fire, stirred it, and began to scrape the cinders. It drew him forth sooner than I expected. He opened the door immediately and said,
"Nelly, come here. Is it morning? Come in with your light."
"It is striking 4, I answered. "You want a candle to take upstairs? You might have lit one at this fire."
"No, I don't wish to go upstairs," he said. "Come in and kindle me a fire, and do anything there is to do about the room."
"I must blow the coals red first before I can carry any," I replied, getting a chair and the bellows.
He roamed to and fro meantime in a state approaching distraction, his heavy sighs succeeding each other so thick as to leave no space for common breathing between.
"When day breaks, I'll send for Green," he said. "I wish to make some legal inquiries of him while I can bestow a thought on those matters, and while I can act calmly. I've not written my will yet, and how to leave my property I cannot determine. I wish I could annihilate it from the face of the earth."
I would not talk so, Mr. Heathcliff, I interposed. Let your will be a while. You'll be spared to repent of your many injustices yet. I never expected that your nerves would be disordered. They are at present marvellously so, however, and almost entirely through your own fault. The way you've passed these 3 last days might knock up a titan. Do take some food and some repose. You need only look at yourself in a glass to see how you require both. Your cheeks are hollow and your eyes bloodshot, like a person starving with hunger and going blind with loss of sleep.
It is not my fault that I cannot eat or rest, he replied. I assure you it is through no settled designs. I'll do both as soon as I possibly can. But you might as well bid a man struggling in the water rest within arm's length of the shore. I must reach it first, and then I'll rest. Well, never mind, Mr. Green. As to repenting of my injustices, I've done no injustice, and I repent of nothing. I'm too happy, and yet I'm not happy enough. My soul's bliss kills my body, but does not satisfy itself.
Happy, master? I cried. Strange happiness. If you would hear me without being angry, I might offer some advice that would make you happier.
What is that? He asked. Give it.
You are aware, Mr. Heathcliff, I said, that from the time you were 13 years old, you have lived a selfish, unchristian life, and probably hardly had a Bible in your hands during all that period. You must have forgotten the contents of the book, and you may not have space to search it now. Could it be hurtful to send for someone, some minister, of any denomination? It does not matter which. To explain it and show you how very far you have erred from its precepts, and how unfit you will be for its heaven, unless a change takes place before you die.
I'm rather obliged than angry, Nelly, he said. Do you remind me of the manner in which I desire to be buried? It is to be carried to the churchyard in the evening. You and Hareton may, if you please, accompany me. And mine particularly, to notice that the sexton obeys my directions concerning the 2 coffins. No minister need come, nor need anything be said over me. I tell you I have nearly attained my heaven, and that of others is altogether unvalued and uncoveted by me.
And supposing you persevered in your obstinate fast, and died by that means, and they refused to bury you in the precincts of the kirk? I said, shocked at his godless indifference. How would you like it?
They won't do that,
he replied.
If they did, you must have me removed secretly. And if you neglect it, you shall prove practically that the dead are not annihilated.
As soon as he heard the other members of the family stirring, he retired to his den, and I breathed freer. But in the afternoon, while Joseph and Hareton were at their work, he came into the kitchen again, and with a wild look bid me come and sit in the house. He wanted somebody with him. I declined, telling him plainly that his strange talk and manner frightened me, and I had neither nerve nor the will to be his companion alone.
I believe you think me a fiend,
he said with a dismal laugh.
Something too horrible to live under a decent roof.
Then, turning to Catherine, who was there and who drew behind me at his approach, he added half-sneeringly,
Will you come, Chuck? I will not hurt you. No. To you I've made myself worse than the devil. Well, there is one who won't shrink from my company. By God, she's relentless. Oh, damn it. It's unutterably too much for flesh and blood to bear. Even mine.
He solicited the society of no one more. At dusk he went into his chamber. Through the whole night and far into the morning, we heard him groaning and murmuring to himself. Hareton was anxious to enter, but I bid him fetch Mr. Kenneth, and he should go in and see him. When he came and I requested admittance and tried to open the door, I found it locked, and Heathcliff bid us be damned. He was better and would be left alone, so the doctor went away. The following evening was very wet. Indeed, it poured down till day dawn, and as I took my morning walk around the house, I observed the master's window swinging open, and the rain driving straight in. He cannot be in bed, I thought. Those showers would drench him through. He must either be up or out. But I'll make no more ado, I'll go boldly and look. Having succeeded in obtaining entrance with another key, I ran to unclose the panels, for the chamber was vacant. Quickly pushing them aside, I peeped in. Mr. Heathcliff was there, laid on his back. His eyes met mine so keen and fierce, I started, and then he seemed to smile. I could not think him dead, but his face and throat were washed with rain. The bedclothes dripped, and he was perfectly still. The lattice flapping to and fro had grazed one hand that rested on the sill. No blood trickled from the broken skin, and when I put my fingers to it, I could doubt no more. He was dead and stark. I hasped the window, I combed his black long hair from his forehead. I tried to close his eyes, to extinguish, if possible, that frightful, lifelike gaze of exultation before anyone else beheld it. They would not shut. They seemed to sneer at my attempts. And his parted lips and sharp white teeth sneered too. Taken with another fit of cowardice, I cried out for Joseph. Joseph shuffled up and made a noise, but resolutely refused to meddle with him.
"T' devil's harried off his soul!"
he cried.
"And he may have his carcass into t' bargain for aught I care. Ech, what a wicked un he looks gurning at death!"
And the old sinner grinned in mockery. I thought he intended to cut a caper round the bed, but suddenly composing himself, he fell on his knees and raised his hands and returned thanks that the lawful master and the ancient stock were restored to their rights. I felt stunned by the awful event, and my memory unavoidably recurred to former times with a sort of oppressive sadness. But poor Hareton, the most wronged, was the only one who really suffered much. He sat by the corpse all night, weeping in bitter earnest. He pressed its hand and kissed the sarcastic, savage face that everyone else shrank from contemplating, and bemoaned him with that strong grief which springs naturally from a generous heart, though it be tough as tempered steel. Mr. Kenneth was perplexed to pronounce of what disorder the master died. I concealed the fact of his having swallowed nothing for 4 days, fearing it might lead to trouble, and then, I am persuaded he did not abstain on purpose. It was the consequence of his strange illness, not the cause. We buried him to the scandal of the whole neighbourhood, as he wished. Earnshaw and I, the sexton, and 6 men to carry the coffin, comprehended the whole attendance. The 6 men departed when they had let it down into the grave. We stayed to see it covered. Hareton, with a streaming face, dug green sods and laid them over the brown mound himself. At present, it is as smooth and verdant as its companion mounds, and I hope its tenant sleeps as soundly. But the country folks, if you ask them, would swear on the Bible that he walks. There are those who speak to having met him near the church and on the moor, and even within this house. Idle tales, you'll say, and so say I. Yet that old man by the kitchen fire affirms he has seen 2 on 'em, looking out of his chamber window on every rainy night since his death. And an odd thing happened to me about a month ago. I was going to the Grange one evening, a dark evening, threatening thunder, and just at the turn of the heights, I encountered a little boy with a sheep and 2 lambs before him. He was crying terribly, and I supposed the lambs were skittish and would not be guided. "What is the matter, my little man?" I asked.
"There's Heathcliff, and a woman yonder, and Nab,"
he blubbered,
"and a dairn at Passham."
I saw nothing, but neither the sheep nor he would go on, so I bid him take the road lower down. He probably raised the phantoms from thinking, as he traversed the moors alone, on the nonsense he had heard his parents and companions repeat. Yet still, I don't like being out in the dark now, and I don't like being left by myself in this grim house. I cannot help it. I shall be glad when they leave it and shift to the Grange.
"They are going to the Grange, then?" I said.
Yes, answered Mrs. Dean. As soon as they are married, and that will be on New Year's Day.
And who will live here then?
Why, Joseph will take care of the house and perhaps a lad to keep him company. They will live in the kitchen and the rest will be shut up.
For the use of such ghosts as choose to inhabit it, I observed.
No, Mr. Lockwood,
said Nelly, shaking her head.
I believe the dead are at peace, but it is not right to speak of them with levity.
At that moment the garden gate swung to. The Ramblers were returning. They are afraid of nothing, I grumbled, watching their approach through the window. Together they would brave Satan and all his legions. As they stepped onto the doorstones and halted to take a last look at the moon, or, more correctly, at each other by her light, I felt irresistibly impelled to escape them again, and pressing a remembrance into the hand of Mrs. Dean, and disregarding her expostulations at my rudeness, I vanished through the kitchen as they opened the house door, and so should have confirmed Joseph in his opinion of his fellow servants' gay indiscretions, had he not fortunately recognized me for a respectable character by the sweet ring of a sovereign at his feet. My walk home was lengthened by a diversion in the direction of the kirk, when beneath its walls I perceived decay had made progress. Even in 7 months, many a window showed black gaps deprived of glass, and slates jutted off here and there, beyond the right line of the roof to be gradually worked off in coming autumn storms. I sought and soon discovered the three headstones on the slope next the moor, the middle one grey and half buried in the heath. Edgar Linton's only harmonized by the turf and moss creeping up its foot. Heathcliff's, still bare. I lingered round them, under that benign sky, watched the moths fluttering among the heath and harebells, listened to the soft wind breathing through the grass, and wondered how anyone could ever imagine unquiet slumbers for the sleepers in that quiet earth.
This has been an Audible Incorporated production of Wuthering Heights. Written by Emily Bronte. Narrated by Joanne Froggatt. Producer Nicola Clayton. Production copyright 2017 by Audible UK Studios.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.